I'm an alcoholic. My name's Dave. First of all, I want to thank the committee and Greg and everybody involved for asking me to come out here and share this weekend. And hell, I've been here since day before yesterday. And I've been sitting here, and we've been working out this afternoon, workshops. And you get kind of wound up about getting up here and getting it over with. And some of you might not know how I feel, but it's a feeling. Cliff knows what I'm talking about. As a matter of fact, as a story I always tell, you might understand it better. And it seems as though years ago in my home state, they had a state convention, and they had one of these long-winded speakers. This guy started talking. After an hour, he covered the 12 steps. Next hour, he got into 12 traditions. Third hour, he got into three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous, on and on. And people began to leave. And they will leave. I found it out one night. And finally, everybody left but one man, except sitting right on the front row. And of course, the speaker got concerned. He wound up his talk, ran down from the podium, grabbed the man by the hand, says, "I want to ask you one question. Everybody left but you. Why did you stay?" And he says, "Hell, I'm the next speaker." Well, now you know how I feel. But it's good to be here, and it's just good to be in an AA meeting anytime. I'm a member of the Big Book Group in Raleigh, North Carolina, which Greg has alluded to quite a bit, and I, too, think it's the best group in the whole wide world. And I've always felt that way about home groups. And it's just the way I feel about it. By God's grace, and because this program works for me, and through the help of some understanding sponsors who led me with a kind but firm hand, through the love of a loving wife that I found as a result of this program, and through the help of many people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm about to give my sobriety date, by the way. In my part of the country, we give our sobriety date. And there's a story behind that. But, you know, every time I give my sobriety date, I talk about one of the old-timers from East Texas, a man named Burton Crawford. And Burton would get up, and by the way, in Texas, if you don't give your sobriety date, they'll shoot you right at the podium. I mean, you give your sobriety date. And Burton would get up and talk. He said, "My name's Burton Crawford, and I've been sober ever since I can remember." Well, when you think about it, that applies to all of us. We've been sober since we can remember. But by God's grace, I've been sober since September 12, 1957. For this, I'm very grateful. I spent over half my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the benefits that I received from the program, a great benefit that I alluded to earlier this afternoon, is I've been one of the fortunate ones that were here in the 50s when what I call an old-timer was here. The old-timers that were old-timers, the legends in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had the experience of being around these people, and my sobriety is built around their philosophy, which is the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all I know. But I give my sobriety date for two reasons, and two reasons only. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in Roanoke, Virginia, an old central group. The second meeting I ever went to in AA was a discussion meeting, and they had 13 or 14 wicker chairs sitting in a circle, and I was no different from anybody else who goes to our first discussion meeting. I began to wonder what I was going to say when it got to me. And it finally got to me, and the man who had become my first sponsor spoke up and told me what to say. He said, "Give your name and your sobriety date. That's all you're qualified to do." And that's the truth. As a matter of fact, after the meeting, he explained to me that's all I was going to be able to do for quite a while, was give my name and sobriety date. The second reason is they had a saying in that group that if you're a member of that group, if it was your home group, you got behind that podium, if you didn't give your sobriety date, you usually didn't have one. So that's the reason I give my sobriety date. I've been sober for a while, and I've received a lot of benefits from this program. Things that I call marginal benefits, such as peace of mind, serenity, some security, a lot of happiness. Things that are on the surface, material things like that. But any time I talk about marginal benefit, I have to talk about basic benefits. And the basic benefit that I receive from this program beyond my sobriety is my sanity. And today, as a sane alcoholic, I find I don't have to run anymore. I don't have to cheat. I don't have to steal. I don't have to lie anymore. And most important of all, I don't have to sober up anymore. And I didn't know that was the name of the game when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous about sobering up. I don't have to sober up anymore. I didn't have any problem drinking. I had a hell of a problem sobering up. And if I say anything this afternoon, first of all, I'm not authority on Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't made the program. Maybe when I die and you bury me, and if I'm still practicing these principles like we speak of, and in good standing, maybe you can say I made the program then. But I'm a firm believer in that God works in mysterious ways for all of us. I think God was working my life forever. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know it. But my beginning in AA is rather interesting to some people. I like to talk about being in AA and how it was for me in my early sobriety and today. But I'm qualified to be here, by the way. I didn't take my first drink until I was 16 years of age in college. I knew what liquor could do to a man because I seen what happened to my father. My father, I didn't know he was an alcoholic until I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about alcoholism until I got into AA and began to know something about the program. But because of his drinking, it led to a divorce in my home when I was 12 years of age. And my mother was able to clothe me, feed me, and send me off and get a good education, a college education, and make something out of my life. And I can remember promising her as a kid that I'll never be like him. I don't know how you were, if you had the same problem I did, but I despised my father. I remember the arguments at night when he was drinking and drunk. And I mean, this was in a good atmosphere on the right side of town. And I can remember that as a kid. And I can remember promising her that I'll never be like him. I'll never be like him. And hell, if the truth is known, I proved to be much worse than my father ever was. He had never had to be put away for a period of time. He never had to be locked up and scrutinized, and he lost a family on account of his drinking. But I didn't take my first drink until I was a freshman in college. I was back around a bunch of fellows that had just come back from World War II and knew how to drink. And I've always said, and I still contend, you know, there are different environments in your drinking and different environments in sobriety. And I was in that environment, and I was around it long enough that I started doing what the big boys were doing. And I worked at it in the beginning, getting it down. You know how we are. We have some trouble, gagging exercises and throwing up and all that stuff. And, I used to hear them talk about the pleasure that comes from drinking, and I didn't understand what the hell they were talking about. And I asked one of them one night, I said, tell me something. When does the pleasure come that you speak of? Never forgot what it says. Dave says, there's a little pause in between from the time you take the drink and when you throw up. That's when the pleasure comes. And I'm sure some of you can identify with that. But I went on through school, and I didn't have any serious problem drinking. I had a good time. I never got in serious trouble. Didn't know what a hangover was. I started doing some strange things along about my senior year. I studied engineering, but because of my basketball ability, when I finished college, I was off a job coaching high school basketball down in Eastern North Carolina. I was raised in Eastern North Carolina, and I went to coaching high school basketball and teaching when I was 20 years of age. And I had some kids who were older than I were when I started teaching. And I fell upstairs in the coaching profession and coaching basketball. And I didn't. My drinking at that time was consisted of drinking on the weekends. I would meet my various fellows or girls I'd been in school with various places. We'd have a weekend party, and then I'd go on about my business. About the second year, I began to drink more frequently during the week. It was at this school that I was promoted. I moved on to a much larger high school further east. I kept moving east in my state. And you keep moving east in my home state, and you finally get out there where it's nowhere to go. And I got there eventually with nowhere to go, but I was at a much larger high school, and I was able to have an impressive record. And I fell upstairs in the coaching profession at a very young age is what happened. But I can look back then, all this is hindsight, that I began to drink during the week at night. I was drinking with school board members. people that drank, and I was able to go in their homes and sit down and enjoy it. Social drinking, I guess, I don't know. And it wasn't long before I found the morning drink, the third year of teaching. I had to have alcohol in my system in order to perform at school. At that time, you wasn't making much money coaching and teaching high school. And this was in the 50s. Well, in the late 40s is when it was, early 50s. And my mother was supplementing the income. I was able to drive a big automobile and carry out the flutes of women and eat the big steaks. And I look back then, I didn't know the value of anything, I guess, until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a mother, and some of you know what I'm talking about when I say my mother loved me to death. My mother just loved me. I was the only boy. I had two sisters. And she had told me, and she helped me quite a bit. I've always said maybe, I don't know, maybe it was a contribution of alcoholism. I don't know. I look back now, and I really think that my alcoholism was hid for a long time. I can remember when I used to be they used to enjoy seeing me kind of loose, you know what I mean, around home, having fun, cutting up and showing off, and they'd laugh a little. I look back now, and the worst scenes that I can remember was my latter stages of drinking when I got in that squirrel cage of drinking, when I was out of control, when I got violent and I didn't know what I was doing. But I can remember back then when they you know, I don't know if your family was like mine, but I can remember when all they wanted to do was push a button and get me well for one night so they could have the next day. I don't know if you understand that or not, but I remember it. I remember it very well. About the second year at this particular school, my drinking got out of control. It got to the point that I was writing bad checks. I wasn't living up to my responsibility to the job that I was employed for. My mother was getting concerned, and they finally called me in one day and talked to me about my drinking. This was the principal of this particular school. And, of course, you know, we're in complete denial, and I denied it all, and I got resentful, and I left very mad about this situation. And, you know, the alcoholic is, he wants to get people off his back at some time in this stage. And so I decided what I'd do, I'd get married. You know, I'd divert their attention. And I knew, I courted a girl in the community for about 2 weeks, and we got married. I got the attention, all right, and this particular lady, she had no idea about my drinking to the degree that it was. And I look back now, and you know, this is the strange thing about Al-Anon that we speak of. The alcoholic affects so many people, so many people. And I look back now, and we lived together about a little over a year until she found out it was useless, and I knew it was useless too, but because of the shame that would be in the community, that we got a divorce. But yet, I'm the community drunk by now, but everybody knows it but she and I. But because of the shame of the divorce, we just lived together for a little over a year and a half in this alcoholism until she finally had to leave. And of course, what eventually happened, I was fired from this school. I wasn't exactly fired. They gave me a chance to leave and because of what was happening in my life. And what was happening in my life, some of it was funny at times and some of it was sad. But prior to this, I had got a sabbatical leave one time. And like I said earlier this afternoon, when I came along, there were no such thing as treatment centers. There were drying out places where they would send you to I had a lot of nervous breakdowns is what they called them. My mother sent me a lot of them up and down the East Coast where you would go and spend a few weeks and taper off. I don't know if any of you ever tapered off. No, I enjoyed tapering off. I mean, you just get loose and sit on a lawn chair and an umbrella and soft green grass and taper off. And I used to come back in worse shape than when I went. And finally, I was back at this particular school and I was asked to leave and resigned. And the wife had left. She had had enough. And I look back now, and I'd gotten to the point then that I'd do just about anything to get a drink of liquor. I'd gotten to that point. But I still had resources. My mother was still helping me. And I had to leave the school on account of a situation that, I wasn't doing my job. And another thing, I got involved with a girls' basketball team. We had a, I was coaching men's basketball, and in the middle of the year, this coach was coaching the girls, had to leave, and they asked me to take over the girls' team. Now, you got to understand something. I was going to these ball games half boozed up, drinking vodka. You know, it leaves you breathless. And you know, I was good and loose. I wasn't drunk, but just right. You know what I mean. Smooth. What did they say now? Cool. And I was just, I mean, I wasn't drunk, but I was moving good. And the first game I had these girls, just before the tip-off, had them in the huddle. And you know, with boys, I always hit them on the rear and give them a... Well, you know what happened. I started hitting the girls on the rear, and hell, parents come down out of the stand. And I really didn't know what I'd done. That's the hell of it. And needless to say, the school board met the next morning. And that was part of my behavior. At that time, I was doing things that I didn't know I was doing. I moved on a little bit further east. I was hired at a particular school. It was a rock bottom of schools, really and truly, in this another county. And in my own mind, I was there to see that the school was accredited and all this stuff, you know. And I lasted 6.5 months. I was having to drive from a residential area where I was living, about 13 miles, this rural consolidated school. And I'd gotten to the point then that the only way I can describe my drinking is I had to get up 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning to drink enough to stop shaking, so I could shave, shower, and get my clothes on, and get to the schoolhouse. And I knew what was going to happen about 11. The shakes would start again, and I'd have some hit in the gym or in the automobile and take a few drinks to stop the shaking and pray for 3 o'clock when I'd go back to town and do the same thing over again. It went on for 6.5 months. And then one day, this man just stopped me. The principal just stopped me in the hall. We didn't have a conference about it. He didn't call me in and discuss this situation. He said, "We don't need you any longer. We just don't need you." Took the keys away from me. Now, I look back, and I had experienced some blackouts before, but never no prolonged blackout. And I really believe, as I look back at what I know today in sobriety, that I'd crossed that invisible line that we speak of, that I'd become an alcoholic at that time. Because I'd gotten to the point in my life where I'd take one drink, and I could no longer guarantee you my behavior. I could no longer guarantee you what was going to happen after I took one drink. And to me, that's what an alcoholic is. One drink. And you know, you don't know what's going to happen. I later found out I left school that day after I was fired in the middle of the day, and I was going in a blackout for a little over 2 weeks. Got into a lot of trouble and got cut up real bad, and I woke up in jail for the first time in my life down in the city where I was living. A man began to talk to me through a cell door one morning, and I've never forgotten what he told me. He said, "Son," says, "your mother has come down here and straightened out all this mess, and we're going to send you to a place where they can cure you." And I didn't know what, I thought maybe it was one of those drying out places again where I could go and taper off. And it wasn't that at all. My mother had made arrangements, and in my home state, the state insane asylum is called Dix Hill. Now, I've often said I too found my thrill on Dix Hill. That's where I went for the cure, and I was 26 or 27 years of age at that time. And I never want to forget my first trip to Dix Hill as long as I live. The day that they admitted me, if you call it that, they put me in what was known as the inebriate ward. I didn't know what it meant then, but it sounded pretty good. And I identified with that environment immediately, because the people I was in that ward with chased squirrels most of the time. They'd run under the chairs, run up the wall, under the beds. And so when you're in Rome, you do as the Romans do. So I chased squirrels too, and never caught one, came close a couple of times. And after a period of about 7 days, if I remember correctly, I began to go into various stages of DTs, hallucinations, and all that stuff. And they carried me down into a basement of this building and put me in a padded cell and let me have my running fits. That was a treatment. That was a treatment. Take your clothes away from you. Lock you up and let you have your running fits. And you don't forget it. And days later, when I got through having my running fits, they gave my clothes back to me, and then I was put upstairs in a ward with rest of the rummies, and then I was allowed to do the only thing I could do for the next 30-some-odd days. And that was walk up and down the corridor day in and day out, wondering what in the hell I was doing there. Because the men there were a lot older than I was. And one night, a bunch of men were playing poker, where they were using matchsticks for chips. They were sitting in a circle, and they began to discuss the reason they were there. And one man spoke up and says, "I'm here because my wife wanted to get rid of me." And I began to identify with that, and I thought my mother wanted to get rid of me. My mother had spent thousands of dollars on me, sending me up and down the East Coast, trying to do something for me. People had prayed over me. I'd been everywhere. The local doctor tried to help me. She just had all she could take, and she did the only thing she needed to do. And that's where I needed to be at that time, I think, looking back. And then I heard a man speak up, and I've always said the face. The man spoke up and says, and I can see his face this afternoon just as clear as it was 40-some years ago. And this man says, "I'm here because I'm an alcoholic." And when I heard the word, one thing popped in my mind, my daddy. That's the only thing I could think of, my daddy. And I began to play a game till the evening I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, comparing my drinking with my father's drinking. And like I said earlier, he proved to be a much better man in his drinking than I did. I was at Dix Hill, and the day came that I had to leave. I didn't know what I would do. I didn't have anywhere to go. Everything I'd accumulated since I graduated from college, I'd lost. The automobiles, the home, the bank account, the wife, the whole works. I had nothing except what I had when I was discharged. And what do? Well, you go back home to mother. And that's what I did. I went back to my home down in eastern North Carolina. And my mother took me in and sent me to the family doctor. And the family doctor, he didn't know anything about alcoholism. And I don't know a thing about drugs, but I do know something about tablets. And the good doctor gave me some tablets to take. And I took those tablets as they were prescribed in the beginning. I was running around with a crowd at night that drank. I've been in school with them, so my college education. We were going eating and dining and just going places. And they were drinking, and I was taking my medicine. And I was using worse shape than they were because of these tablets. And then one night, they passed the bottle. I'd been at home 9 weeks, if I remember. And I decided I'd have a drink. And the progression that we speak of, as we learn in sobriety, began to set in, and I found out that something I never knew. I went back to the place I said I'd never go again as long as I live, back to Dix Hill. To make a long story short, I went back to Dix Hill 5 times in 6 months on account of one fact. I become an alcoholic, and I didn't know it. The last time I went back, and I knew something about Aunt Abuse, too. I took it one time. Took it several times. But the last time I took it, I tried drinking wine on top of it. And it don't work, in case you're interested. And this time, they took me back to Dix Hill. They put me in the nut part of the bug house instead of the drying out part. And there is a distinct difference. And this was the time I found out being strapped down on the bed in straight jackets and how you live better electrically. I found out about that, too. And I look back now, and the people that I were around in that ward were crazy. And I was with them. There's no doubt about it. And I began to accept the fate that I would be there. And one day, and like I said earlier, God worked in a mysterious way. Maybe it was a coincidence. I don't know. But by some strange coincidence, one day they came and got me. And carried me back over to the rummy ward and put me over there with the rest of the rummies. Now, I'd been there so much, it more or less made me an honorary attendant. I worked in the kitchen and did artist jobs. You know, I was a regular fellow there. Young fellow, they kind of looked on me as a mystery. And then one day, going to get the mail, two other fellows and myself decided we'd leave. We escaped. We ran like hell is what we did. Back then in my hometown of Raleigh, Dix Hill, a huge fence, cyclone fence around it, and it was like cops and robbers then. I mean, they came after you. We ran like hell. It was a major thing. That afternoon, we were in a hotel, 3 hours drinking and sitting there, and the evening news came on, television. And it came out with three criminal insane people just escaped from Dix Hill. And one of them said, wonder who the hell it is. And sure enough, they popped up some pictures, and one cried, and one laughed like hell, and we decided we'd better split up if we become gangsters, you know. And so we split up, and the next morning, a friend of the family knew my mother, saw me on the streets, and decided he'd try to help me get me back home, and kind of knew my background, what had been happening to me, and put me on a Trailways bus and sent me back to Roanoke Rapids down northeast of North Carolina. And unbeknownst to me, my mother was in Richmond, Virginia, in a hospital from a nervous breakdown. I broke into my home where I was raised and stayed there for a few days until the bride brought her home from the hospital and found me there. I'd been all drunked up, you know, and taking advantage of people in my hometown. Finally, they got together one afternoon. I'd been there a couple of days, and when I say, I don't know if you know who they are or not, but they are those people that put you in one room, and they get in the other, and they crack the door, and they begin to talk about how much they love you, about what they got to do. And they, at that time, were my two sisters, my mother, and a friend of the family, like a father to me. And one of them came in and began to talk to him and said, you're killing mother. We want you to leave this part of the country. And they really meant for me to leave. They gave me a wad of money and wished me luck. And I began to agree that it was a good idea when I saw that money. You know how we are. And you know, you get that green on your hip and things. I could get see things I thought was a good idea, too. And it was enough money to go west and live comfortable for a period of time. And I went 4 miles to a neighboring town. And pulled into what is known as the Weldon Hotel. Now, Weldon Hotel in its day was a prominent hotel. It's where the Atlantic Coast Line Railroad and the Seaboard Coast Line used to meet, change trains and so forth. It was a railroad center. And had a lot of friends for about 4 months until the money ran out, and my friends began to disappear. And one day, I was out of money, and so, you know, when you're out of money, you got to do something. And I went over to my hometown. I bought an outboard motor, but I didn't have a boat, but I bought a motor and, you know, write a big check, pick up the change and worry about the motor later. And the fellow was a friend of the family. I called my mother 2 days later and tell her that my motor was ready, and she put two and two together. And that afternoon, John Law was over there in that hotel and got me out of there and carried me back to my hometown and put me in jail for the first time in my hometown. 3 blocks from my mother's home. Nobody came to see me. And my sister was city clerk, and they took me upstairs and tried me in the court of law for something I didn't know I'd done on a previous drunk. And she didn't seem to know who I was. The city solicitor was my mother's next-door neighbor, and he didn't seem to know who I was either. Nobody seemed to know me. And one night down there in the jail, I was raising hell about I wanted to see my attorney. I was getting concerned. I'd been there a week. And they hadn't let me out. Everybody had come in. There was drunk tanks out the next morning except me. And I got the jailer down there raising hell. And I said, I want to see my attorney. He said, who is your attorney? And I told him. He said, talk to him all you want to. He's in the next cell block. And sure enough, he was. And strange, maybe this was a coincidence. This man later became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and served in our state legislature and died sober. But he sure couldn't help me that night. And so after that little escapade in my hometown, they took me down the road a little bit further and to another courthouse where I had to stand trial for something I didn't know I'd done on a previous drunk in a blackout. And the end result was that I moved east. They put me on a chain gang down in eastern North Carolina in the Great Dismal Swamp. All those beer cans and bottles that I threw in the ditches, I didn't know I was going to have to come back and pick them up. And that's what I had to do, and cut bushes. And I worked harder than I ever worked in my life. And there was a lot of shame involved. I didn't like to talk about it when I first got sober. My first sponsor says, you got to talk about it because that's what's got you here. I believe it. It got me to alcohol. It was a part of me coming here. And I'm here to tell you tonight that I don't know what stage you are if you're here. fighting this thing about Alcoholics Anonymous or what you're thinking about AA, you don't have to do the things I did to get to AA and find sobriety. I've got friends in AA today. I sponsored people that put the plug in the jug and they come on here and make mighty good numbers. I was one of these people that had to be beat down to my knees before I could see myself. And that's the thing that I understand about this disease today. Even as long as I've been sober and the people I work, that's the inability of the alcoholic to see himself as he really is in his worst moments. We cannot see ourselves as we really are. Complete denial. And this is the thing that just about killed me. I could not see myself as I really was. Nobody in the family had much to do with me. Nobody did. And the day came that I had to leave this particular place, they carried me back to my hometown, putting me out at the city limits. And I don't know. I just went back to home again. Went back to my mother. For some strange reason, I didn't go to the front door. I went to the back door, and I guess I was second class by now. And that afternoon, my mother began to talk to me, and she fed me, called me in the kitchen, and set me down. And it wasn't long before they got together again. You know, the prodigal son has come home. We better have a meeting. And sure enough, they did. They cracked that door again. And even my brother-in-law came over this time, and he got into it. And I won't get into that. But anyway, it wasn't long before I heard my mother say, "That's my son. He stays here tonight, whether you like it or not." And that's when I made a vow before I ever got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried staying, not the word sobriety, not staying sober, but I just wouldn't drink anymore for her. I don't recommend this before AA or after AA. And I was able to do it for about 4.5 months. My mother took me back in again and clothed me and loved me and tried to help me, really and truly. And I decided I wanted to do something in return, and it was finally suggested maybe I should go to work. It had been a long time. And through agency up in Richmond, Virginia, I was interviewed for several jobs in 3 different states in a period of 1 week. My mother carried me to these places, and one afternoon we wound up in Roanoke, Virginia. On a particular Thursday afternoon, a man began to talk to me. It was superintendent of city schools, and he was impressed. And he said, "I got to have some reference to school. We're starting in 10 days. And he said, "I got to have some reference." I gave him some, and he said, "Let me get on the telephone. You sit right here." And he went on in another office, and I told my mother, "Well, it's all over with now." And I thought it would be because he came back and began to talk to me. He said, "I understand you had a problem with drinking at one time, but that you're cured now." And I hadn't taken a drink in about 4.5 months, and I didn't know what cure it was, but I agreed, "Yes, sir, I had." and I didn't think I'd take a drink. You know, I didn't know what my problem was. And sure enough, we went back to my hometown, Roanoke Rapids, and my mother financed the whole thing and started me in a new life in spite of where I'd been and what had happened to me in my previous life. I had a nice place to go to, a nice home to stay. Had a job, had new clothes, I had some money in my pocket, and a new life in spite of where I'd been. And on the way back to Roanoke, I had changed buses in Richmond. And I decided I'd have one drink, but I bought 2 pints. You know how we are. And this was the beginning of my last drunk, the only drunk that I really like to talk about, because this is the drunk that got me into Alcoholics Anonymous. I got back and didn't go to the place I was supposed to. I checked into the big hotel on the hill to live it up, and I lived it up. And I was able to work for about 5 days, and I had the Asian flu, if you know what I mean. And the school authorities tried to help me. They came over and gave me another chance, and I couldn't respond. And it wasn't long before the hotel where I was staying was trying to kick me out. They knew my mother and got in touch with her, and she got in touch with me on the telephone about midway this drunk and gave me the greatest gift she's ever given me since the day I was born. And that's when she kicked me out of her life, and I knew she meant it. I knew she meant it. And wished me luck and told me never to come home again. And about a week later, I was on the streets in Roanoke on Skid Row doing the best I could. On Sunday morning, September 11th, 1957, I was in a back alley in downtown Roanoke, contemplating getting a drink of liquor down. I got to the point on this last drunk that I don't know if you were like me or not. I hurt all over. My hair hurt. My toenails hurt. I was tired of the high cost of low living, and that's what it is. And I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I wanted to do something different. And I was in that back alley, and it finally dawned on me that what I was doing, I was dying from it. And I'd probably die in that back alley if I kept on doing it. And the revelation came to me that, my God, I thought I was a leper. I thought I was the only man like me at that time, in spite of the way I'd been and what I knew. And maybe God worked in mysterious ways that morning. That superintendent of city schools had been looking for me for several days and found me. And he took me to his home that afternoon and got in touch with another man that knew a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'd heard about AA twice. One time I'd heard about it, well, I heard about it several times when I was in Dix Hill, over there in the insane asylum where they had all the noon. They used to, on Sunday mornings, the fellows in Raleigh would come over and put on the AA meeting, and they'd say, the AAs are here, and I'd go in there and drink the coffee and eat the donuts and sit in the back of the room and raise hell. Just try to break up the meeting. You know, I'd figured out after I'd been sober about 5 years that every Sunday afternoon those fellows left, but I had to stay. It took me 5 years to figure that out. That's the first time I heard about AA was in Dix Hill. The second time was when I came off the chain gang, my mother got in touch with an old timer in my hometown that took me down to a place called Rich Square, North Carolina, to talk to an attorney named Vernon Strickland. Vernon was a very successful lawyer in eastern North Carolina, became a drunk, wound up out in the Cleveland Akron area, and Dr. Bob got hold of him and got him sober. And worked with him about back to eastern North Carolina. Started his law practice and started the oldest group in eastern North Carolina in a place called Rich Square. And this man took me down there to talk to Vernon one day. And Vernon sat down and took the time to talk to me about Alcoholics Anonymous and tell me what it was about, what it could do for me. And he got through, and I told him I was too young to be an alcoholic. My brain had been about tickled by then, but I was too young to be an alcoholic. And I never forgot what Vernon told me. He said, son, says, I tell you, I got through with my dissertation. He said, well, son, says, I tell you what. You keep on drinking and be patient, and you'll find out what you're an alcoholic or not. And a year and a half later, I was an Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's what I knew about AA when I got to AA that day. They took me to a place. That man took me down to a clubhouse called the Easy Does It Club in downtown Roanoke. And you got on. I wasn't drunk. I was rum dumb. I hadn't eaten in a long time. But they had to carry me up the steps because I was so weak. And I remember when I walked in that big room, that lobby, people began to look me over. We say we don't look them over when they come in. By God, you look me over. Because what I had was what I had on. A paper bag that had an ear syringe, a razor, a toothbrush, and 10 pennies. That's what I had when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they began, the principal and the superintendent began to talk to some people, and an old man standing in the corner wiggled his fingers at me. And I waddled over to him, and this man became a part of my sobriety. He was named Old Man John, is what we called him. And this man put his arm around my shoulder and said, son, says, I tell you something. He says, all you got to do is listen to these people and do what they tell you to do, and you never have to be alone again. That's all he told me. Just do what they tell you to do, and you never have to be alone again. And unbeknownst to me, what Old Man John was telling me is what was read by Bob a while ago. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. That's what he was telling me. Just do what they tell you to do, and you never have to be alone again. And so the two men that carried me there left, and AA just took me over. I began to complain a little after about an hour about my nerves, and I said something about a drink, and they said, no, we don't do it that way. Then I said something about some tablets, and I thought I'd start a revolution when I said that. And they said, drink the coffee. And what I'm about to say is no reflection of who made the coffee today, but I've always said, and I still contend, that there are a hell of a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous making coffee that ain't got no business doing it. And that was one of those days. It was that ropey stuff. It just hung. Just hung, and they said, drink the coffee. Well, I thought it was a requirement. So I drank coffee all the afternoon. I got sick from it, drinking that damn stuff. And they carried me to my first meeting that night, and I don't know what went on. I just remember wanting to go out to one. I remember sitting on my hands. But the most important thing that I do remember is after the meeting, strangers walked up to me and told me the magic words of Alcoholics Anonymous. We love you, we understand, and you're going to be all right. Nobody asked me where I came from, what I had, if I had insurance. Nobody asked me a damn thing. They just said, we love you, we understand, and you're going to be all right. And three men got me a room that night in the YMCA and proved to me I didn't have to be alone again. They stayed with me all night long. That's how I got sober. Three members of Alcoholics Anonymous staying in a hotel room, a YMCA room, what it was, talking to me all night long about AA, about not drinking, and what it could do for me. Now, I remember the sun coming up. It was getting bright, and old Claude had been there. Claude spoke up. The first time I ever heard it, he said, Dave, said, what we, all you got to do is not drink today. And said, that's what we do. We just do it a day at a time. First time I ever heard it was that morning. And I don't know about you, but I really believe that that's when I came to believe. I came to believe that maybe I could do it that day. But for some strange reason, back in the dark recesses of my mind that morning, I knew one thing very clearly, that if I was going to make it that day, I had to be around them to do it. For some reason, I had to be around them to do it. And that's the way I feel about it today. I still got to be around you to do it. And that's the reason I'm here today. That's the reason I still go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I still got to be around you to do it, to have that day. And they took me back down to the club room. I met the man who had become my first sponsor. I did not select him. He pointed himself, and the man began to sit down, and he had 5 years sobriety at that time, and he worked with a lot of drunks. The man gave a lot of, and he was what I needed. And he began to ask me questions, and I lied a little, and he said, stop. Look, I don't need all that crap. You're lying. Well, I didn't know how you need that. I know now, because I've been sober for a while, and I've heard the same thing. I don't know. It's something that we learn very quickly, is how the alcoholic lies. But he began to ask me questions. All my answers were negative, and the sum result was, he said, well, it seems to me that you're not doing so hot. And I began to think, no, I'm not doing so hot. My first day in AA is when I began to find out something about trust. Because we left that meeting that after he just talked down and sat down, he asked me three things. He says, do you want to quit drinking worse than anything else on God's green earth? And I said, I did. Are you willing to do what we tell you to do? And I said, I would. Then he asked me a question, and Dr. Bob spoke about it. Are you willing to quit drinking forever? And I lied. I knew what forever was. And he said, well, good, we'll go ahead. And they took me downtown with him. He had to go to the barber shop. And he said, there's a restroom over there. You go in there and see if you can get some eggs in you or something in you. Gave me a $10 bill. And said, when you get through eating, come on over to the barber shop. And a $10 bill to me then, the shape I was in, I began to question, you know, what my allegiance really was at that time. My God, he trusts me that much. I'm a stranger to him, and he's a stranger to me, but he trusts me. And I got some eggs in me and got them down. I went back to that barber shop, and I had about $8 some cents in change, and he got through. And I handed him the money. He said, no, you keep it. You'll have to do it for somebody else someday if you stay sober. And he got me a room in a boarding house where I live with six of us. Each one of us had a room. Out of those six men, 2 hours are sober today. One is drinking and three of them are dead. Two of them went back to drinking. And I learned much from these men. We had meetings after meetings. I got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and finally I had some odd jobs there for a while. I met my second wife, Sue, after I'd been sober for a while, about 2 or 3 months, I guess, and this was another gift that the program gave me. It wasn't long before I began to get a little stability, and that group was a unique group. They finally let me talk after I'd been sober 9 months. And by God, I was ready for them, let me tell you. And the steering committee met on it, and what had happened, one of the fellows at the home had got drunk. And the other fellows had brought him and propped him up in the back, you know, and immediately I saw this, and I said, well, I need to talk to him. Have you ever talked to a real drunk? And so I started a talk on how not to slip. I never heard of one being done, but I started one, and this one wasn't completed either, by the way. I'd been talking about 5 minutes, and I heard somebody say, sit down. Now, when you stark raving sober, you don't listen good. And I was stark raving sober, and my sponsor was speaking and said, sit down. And I kept on going, and finally he come to the podium, grabbed me by the hand, and took me to my seat. Now, as I was walking down that center aisle, everybody's eyes were big, powerful, you know, big. This is something new in the group. And the thing that crossed my mind was, my God, I got too much power for him tonight, and he don't want me to overdo it. That's all it is. Now, you can begin to understand what kind of shape I was in after 9 months of sobriety. I've been hanging around these damn people that told me to take what I wanted and throw the rest away, and I damn near went with it. Until one night, they called me into a room in that conference room. I don't know if you know what a conference room is in your group, but they had one in that old center group, and what they did, they'd call you in and take your inventory. Well, unsolicited, they'd just sit down. And they'd take your damn inventory without even questioning you. I mean, giving you a chance, but they'd just take your inventory. They're old-timers. They called me in there one night, and that particular night, they began to talk to me, and the end result was that they told me that unless I got a hold of the 12 steps and got honest with myself, I was going to get drunk. I'd been sober about a year at that time, and this is a hell of a thing to tell the backbone of the group that you're going to get drunk. I got mad, and I left. But just as I got to the door, my sponsor spoke up and said, I want to ask you one question before you leave. When was the last time you thanked God for a day of sobriety? God, it made me mad. And I went on back to that boarding house. I shut myself up in my room. Now, I didn't think about taking a drink, but I wanted to get back at them. You know, you dealt with sponsors. Well, you want to twist something. You want to... I want to do something to them. And so I sat down and wrote a written resignation to Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I was beginning to do this thing, I kept hearing his voice. It got louder and louder. When was the last time you thanked God for a day of sobriety? And it got louder and louder and louder until I was forced to my knees to pray to a God at that time after a little over a year in AA. God to me then was a question mark in the sky. Maybe yes, maybe no. But the end result of a juvenile prayer, I was able to walk in the bathroom and look at myself for the first time in my life, eyeball to eyeball in a mirror, and know what I really was. That I was just a speck on this universe, and someday I'll die and soon be forgotten. And the only way I had to go was through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I tried everything else. And so the next night, I rejoined Alcoholics Anonymous. I became a member of the clique. I got there before the meetings and did what was asked to be done, and stayed after the meeting and helped clean up. And I began to do these things. I've been sober for a few months, and this was a unique group. I've learned much more from people less education than I. The man that solved my employment problem had a third-grade education. His name was Red. He was a sign painter. One night they called me in the conference room to talk to me about my employment problem. And, you know, we have all the answers if you just listen to us, particularly when we're stark raving sober. And they begin to talk about what I ought to do. And Red speaks up. And Red says, Dave, it seems to me that if you studied engineering in college, that's what you ought to be doing in life. Well, hell, nobody ever explained to me that way before. And so, his advice, I sought out employment with the Virginia Highway Department and was hired. I told a man, they had told me, said, tell him the truth. And I told him the truth about it. And my God, you know, when you tell the truth, there's no resistance. They don't even know. He was amazed and said, we're willing to help you. When can you go to work? This was a... about 2 weeks before Christmas in 57. And I said, well, I tell you, I got a lot of business to do. Scared to death. I said, it'll be about the 1st of February. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, said, you come on back first to Fort Worth, we're going to put you to work. And so I went on back out the car, and Red was out there with Sue, and they began to talk. Wanted to know if I got the job. Said, yep. When do you go to work? And I told them what happened. They carried my ass right back, and I went to work that afternoon. And I worked to, I retired a few months ago, well, a few years ago, in 99. And what happened briefly is I got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was close to 2 years sobriety, and I had to move back to North Carolina in order to get a divorce from my first wife, in order to marry Sue. And I moved back to Raleigh in 59 and got involved there, a man who was my second sponsor. By the way, I'm on my fifth sponsor. Four of them have died, and the last one was rather reluctant. As a matter of fact, it's a man that I sponsor, and he's got 38 years, but I just ran out. And this man is not only a friend, but is a man that I admire very much because I've seen him grow in AA. And I sponsor him. I know what his life's about. So we share with one another, and this is good for me. But anyway, I moved to North Carolina. Man, become my second sponsor was one of the members, the first 100 members of Alcoholics Anonymous in New York. He married a lady in Raleigh, and he was traveling out of Raleigh to Atlanta doing his work. And he was another man that gave me a lot. He's the man that ran the big book down my throat. When I moved to Raleigh, you know, I'd ask people questions to let them know how smart I was. And Tom would say, read the book, read the book. And then he'd talk to me. And I was about 5 years sober. I'd been going to some of these conventions and retreats and so forth and watch these jokers talk. And everybody hugged and clapped and kissed them and everything. I told him one night I wanted to talk to him after the meeting. And that old Hayes Barton group, my second home group, they had a conference room, too. And he was one of these people that stood up and made you sit down. He talked down at you. And he said, what's the problem? I said, Tom, I think I'm a convention speaker. Well, I can't repeat what he said, but a moratorium put on my speaker for the next 2 years, if I remember correctly. He said right then, he said, you can talk all you want to in the discussion meeting, but you'll not speak behind the podium and tell your story till I tell you. 2.5 years later, he called me one day over to his house, wanted to talk to him. He said, sit down. And I sat down, and he stood up. And I've never forgotten this. He said, Dave, said, you're going down to Columbia, South Carolina, talk at the state convention. You do this. He told me everything to do. You do this, you do that. Before you go, there's something I want to tell you. They asked me to go first. I can't go, and you're going as a damn substitute speaker, and don't you ever forget it as long as you live. And, you know, I don't know how many you asked before me, but that's life. I've been substituting all my life ever since I've been sober behind this podium, and it works for me, and I don't regret it a bit, but he taught me much. And he was the man that got me interested in service work, and through him I was able to meet Bill Wilson later on because he was a close friend of Bill's. And I, too, served as a delegate and later on as a trustee for the southeastern region. So I've had a lot of experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous because of him. My next two sponsors are men that I got one of them because I thought he was a little bit slow. But Willett was faster than I was. I'd been sober for a while, and I asked Willett one night, he had said in the book, says, we're amazed before we're half through. I said, Willett, when am I going to be half through? He said, don't you ever worry. You'll never be half through. And he came out with things like that. One night I was talking, I was 8 years sober out in Texas, and he was with me. And he got up and come to shake my hand, I thought, and he says, when are you going to talk? Well, hell, I just got through, I fought, and things like that. It disturbs you. And then one night I was somewhere, and he was with me, and then he says, have you ever thought about telling that thing backwards one time? And it makes you think. And this is the thing about old-timers that I found out in my sobriety. You know, they talk to you, and when you, at first you think it's a compliment. But when you think about it and analyze it, it's not that at all. It's not that at all. So Willett and then Earl, and Earl died, and then I got Hoss, my present sponsor, so I've been blessed. I really have. Now, I've been sober for a few years, and what time did I start? Oh, God. Watch don't mean nothing when we get up and look at it in case you're interested. What time you eat?
6:30.
What time does he talk?
8?
Well, we're going about 8 and see what we can do. But anyway, no, I'm kidding you. I got involved in service work, and I moved back to Raleigh and got involved with sponsoring people, and still sponsor people. And Griggs is one of the youngest. I got a man that's 76 years old I sponsor, and he's the youngest. And I'm involved with people, and sponsorship to me is, as I've said earlier, you know, if they get half of what I got, they're going to get it, because I got the whole load in sponsorship, and that's a part of my life. And whether you know it or not, we're playing with people's lives when we sponsor people. It's not something I just talk about. I'm going to become a part of that person's life, and he's going to become a part of my life. And I've been blessed with a lot of people that I enjoy being around, because really and truly, they help me more than I've helped them in sponsorship. Maybe it's somebody like I was after being sober for a period of time. You begin to wonder about this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I know I did, and after I've been sober, maybe you got to get a hold of one word. It's the truth. I heard a man say many years ago when I first got sober that when Jesus Christ walked the face of the earth in the body of a man, he didn't say, "I'm the truth of man." He said, "I am the truth." I believe it's in this source, in this root, that we inherited the program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I've seen enough in my time not only to believe but to know that there is a power behind this universe to stand ready to help you and I if we're willing to help ourselves. I don't care what color you are, where you come from, or what you got, or how broke you are. If you have the capacity to be honest with yourself and you're willing to work this program, it'll work for you. And God takes over in your life. My mother, after I got sober, my mother couldn't believe how I could get sober for a bunch of strangers and I couldn't do it for her. And it took about 9.5 years for me to ever be a part of her life again. My sponsor tried talking to her, and my wife at that time tried to talk to her, and it was just to no avail. She couldn't understand it. And God does work in mysterious ways. I'd been sober 9.5 years and back in my hometown, had to make an AA talk. It was a alcoholism week or something in the community, and they had me down there, you know, local boy makes good and all that stuff. They were glad to see me in town and make good, because, hell, I was discouraged there for a while. And I asked my mother to come to the meeting, and she wouldn't come. I left that afternoon, went on back to my hometown, Raleigh, and I guess about 9 or 10 o'clock, I got a phone call from my mother. And she was crying. She was crying and asking me to forgive her for what she'd done to me in my sobriety. And I couldn't understand what had happened. And I later found out what had happened. Two old ladies that lived on the same block as my mother knew me as a kid. Heard about the scourge. They're the ones that used to call my mother until I was in there. There was a drunk in the front yard, laying around there rolling. And mother said, "No, that's Dave. He's just relaxing." I'd pass out in unusual places, cutting the grass sometime, and going in the wrong neighbor's yard. But they went home after that meeting to talk to my mother and tell her what Alcoholics Anonymous was really about and what I was about. And, you know, God works through people and worked through those two old ladies for her to understand it. And she called me, and she later became one of the greatest friends of Alcoholics Anonymous that's ever been. As a matter of fact, them people in my hometown, they'd try to get me down to talk, they'd call her. And she'd call me and said, "I told them you'd come, and I'd have to go." And my mother lived to see me sober 32 years, and I'm very grateful for that. And I've always said, you know, sobriety prepares us for many things. I retired in 1990. My mother died in 89. This was a blow. I thought I was ready for it, but I wasn't. But AA was part of my life. The people in Alcoholics Anonymous just couldn't believe it, particularly my sisters. I got one sister that says now she wants to become a drunk. We have more fun than anybody she's ever seen. And my other sister, she's getting loose now about it also. They begin to understand more about me and my life and AA through you people, not me.
but through you people.
And, you know, it's like Cliff said earlier today in the tradition workshop, we reach many people by just being a part of people's lives and sharing and caring. And some time ago, I lost my second wife. This was hard. This was hard. But, you know, God takes care of things. I asked God to take care of them, and he did. And she died a horrible death, really. But she battled it, and she was good to me. And she was a good woman. And I didn't think I'd, you know, I didn't know what was going on in my life. But people in AA got around me. And you know, if you just hang on, things are going to get better. I know that. And like I said before, God closes doors, but he opens windows. And the lady that's here with me this weekend is a lady that I've known for some years that's going to become my wife. And I found her in AA. But people just being a part of my life is just something I can't explain. And Julie and I are going to be married in January. And stand up, Julie. This is an unusual story, but it's happened in AA, and I thank God for it. And I've got to say something, and I hope she doesn't get mad at me about it, but I'm going to say it. Back in, before my wife died, she talked to me. And I remember her saying to me, I want you to remarry. You need somebody in your life. But she said, don't marry a bitch. I'll never forget as long as I live. And she's not a bitch, I'll tell you that. Now, I've been sober for quite some time. In spite of my sobriety, I know this. There are certain things I have to do. And one of the things I have to do is I still have to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous because that's where it's at. I still have to work at my sobriety. You know, I have to continue to have a monumental desire to stay sober, and that's what it's all about. I have to try to work these 12 steps to the best of my ability because that's the program. You know, it says in our book, we're granted a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition. I happen to believe that with all my heart that I've been a better person that's trying to work these 12 steps. My spiritual condition has improved. I've been able to help people because of knowing things about myself that helps other people. And the third thing I have to do is I have to become a part of my home group and do what they ask me to do and be a part of it, care. And I feel like anybody that comes to that door have the same right to receive what I did. It's my responsibility to see that they get it. The fourth thing I have to do is I have to, and you know what I'm talking about. Some days I just have to hang on and do the best I can. My sponsors told me years ago, said, you're going to have to, nothing so bad that it won't get better. Nothing so bad that a drink of liquor is going to help. You just hang on and things will get better. And it's through this that I feel like yesterday is my experience. And tomorrow is my hope. And today is going from one to the other and doing the best I can. And as long as I can walk hand in hand with you down this happy road of destiny that we speak of, I too will believe I may allow another day of sobriety. God's been good to me. Maybe it's a coincidence that I'm here and people that I know over the years have shared and care. Well, if it is a coincidence, I have to find a coincidence of act of God in the midst of time. The same God that has been doing for you and I that which we could not do for ourselves. God, the Father of all mankind. There's a few lines in the book that if I'd got up and said these lines when I started, I could have sat down because it would have told my story and probably yours. And it's very powerful. For a while, I used to say it with my lines, that some people got to reading the book and begin to check up. But it's in the book, and it tells my story and probably yours, and it means so much to me because it's me and what I've received from this program. And that released me from the bondage of hatred and replace it with love is just another affirmation of the truth I know. I get everything I need in Alcoholics Anonymous, and everything I need I get. And when I get what I need, I invariably find that it was just what I wanted all the time. Thank you.